great calls. So, take a look on Facebook for Gan Rocks, and I'm looking forward to seeing you at Ganspring Rock 2026 on April the 25th.
Hi, I'm Alan Cross. You may know me as the guy who does the ongoing history of new music. You're listening to CFRC 101.9.
Thank you very much for joining us for the Queen's speaker series. I'm delighted to welcome Desiree Leclerc, who joins us from the University of Georgia. Before I tell you a bit more about Desiree and her work, I wanted to acknowledge that we are, of course, here on the traditional territories of the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe peoples. And I always find it tricky to do this land acknowledgement because we tend to say that we're grateful for opportunity to live and work on these lands. And that sounds very positive, but of course, we also have to keep in mind that the injustices that led to the situation where the indigenous peoples were displaced from this land are, of course, continuing. And as someone who teaches property, I'm very aware of the way in which the premises that allowed the colonial England to kind of assert crown sovereignty over all these lands are still very much embodied in our law, right? And still manifest in the ways in which indigenous peoples have to fight to assert their Aboriginal title, whereas the crown just gets to assert it. And so I don't want to start us off on a negative note, but I think we have to keep that in mind that as grateful as we are to be here, these injustices are still part of our law. But it's all the better that we have Desiree Leclerc here, whose work is very much focused on helping those who have been at the margins of our established legal systems to assert their voice, and in particular in this paper, Empowerment in International Law, she's someone who's holding our government's feet to the fire, right? And even especially when they're clapping themselves on the back for how progressive they are and how much they've been done doing for workers in Mexico. Desiree is, I think, the foremost voice out there who is critical of and looks critically at what is actually happening on the ground. And there's really nobody is better positioned to do that because of her background, because most people who study labor provisions and trade agreements are trade lawyers. And they're just so happy that to see that things are being done for workers. And so they see these provisions and they see dispute settlement and they see activity and they think, oh, it's all so good. Desiree is by training is a labor lawyer. She has incredible experience having worked for 8 years at the International Labor Organization in Geneva. And that is what's so striking about her work is that as a labor lawyer comes at these with a very different perspective because they actually have a sense of how labor law functions, which trade lawyers don't normally do. And so we are incredibly lucky in the trade law community that we have Desiree among us who's teaching us about labor law and providing this critical perspective on labor provisions and trade agreements, which have really moved to the center of the attentions, particularly in North America, in the context of the USMCA or CUSMA between Canada, Mexico, and the United States. So without further ado, thank you so much for coming all the way from the University of Georgia and sharing your research with us. Yes,
right. Thank you. I'd like to say thanks to Professor Lamb and Natalie and the rest of the team for inviting me here and making this such a seamless trip. So I've really enjoyed already getting to see your campus and, you know, some of the beautiful atmosphere. I wouldn't say I love the weather. I'll just be honest. I told Nicholas the next time we do this, it should be in the summertime. But that being noted, I am incredibly privileged to be here. So thank you. And it's my honor to be able to talk about this today because, as is mentioned by Professor Lamp, this is such a critical moment in time for us to be looking at the intersection of our trade relations and those whose work makes trade possible. You know, we talk a lot in trade class about production methods and various costs of competition, but we often lose sight of the women and men who make that trade possible, who deliver our goods, who, you know, are out there in the fields, who are manufacturing, who are thinking of new ideas. If it weren't for the workers, we wouldn't have trade, we wouldn't have our economy, we certainly wouldn't have profits or our standards of living that we do right now. And notwithstanding the critical position of workers, they're usually the last thought in our trade discussions. As Professor Lamp noted, I worked at the ILO for 8 years after working for the United States National Labor Relations Board, but then I left the ILO to work for the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. And so I didn't just see the labor angle, I also saw the trade and more specifically the political angle. So I was hired by the Obama administration, thinking that I was going to be working eventually for the first female president in the United States. And surprise, I instead got to work for President Trump during his first administration for his 4 years before I left to join Cornell University at that time. And I was a labor lawyer. I came at things from the position of helping workers. And I was working for an administration that, as we see now, shall we say, has other priorities in mind. But notwithstanding those other priorities, workers took a center stage in the trade conversations and in our negotiations. When people hear that I worked for Trump as well as Obama, they ask me, well, what was it like working for Trump, you know, after you worked for this wonderfully progressive president? You know, was that hard for you? And they're always really surprised when I tell them that as far as my job went, so this small niche, this protecting workers in trade, it was 10 times easier to work for President Trump than it was for Obama. I know it's not necessarily intuitive, but Obama cared about a lot of things, including workers. He also cared about our geopolitical relationships a lot. He cared about maintaining trust, maintaining legitimacy, and he was loath to upset his trade partners. So when we as negotiators were dealing with questions of trade and of labor commitments, the trade partner could violate their labor commitments. And under the Obama administration, we still had to make the relationship work. And our trade partners knew it. So they didn't take as seriously some of their commitments. Under the Trump administration, it was the opposite. The administration was looking for any excuse to get out of our arrangements and out of our commitments. And worker rights were as good of an excuse as any. So all we had to do was sit down with our trade partners and suggest a question of compliance. And our trade partners would open their books. They would open their labor legislation and they would effectively invite us in because they knew that if we were not supportive of their efforts, that all it would do would be for us to identify that trade partner, that commitment, and our president would be more than happy to pull us out of whatever commitments they had made. So this is all to suggest that the intersection of trade and labor geopolitics is complex. It's not always what we think it will be. You can't always see the president or the trade policymaker and think that you know what their position is going to be, because the intersection between trade economics and the workers that make trade policy is so interlinked that one effort for trade necessarily affects the other for labor and vice versa. So with that bit of background, I'm now going to walk you through kind of a recent project that I did and what the implications of that project are for the future. So here's a kind of a roadmap. I'm going to be discussing the U.S. worker-centered trade policy because that's what I know a lot about. But just to explain that this is not unique to the United States. So just as the United States in recent years has begun saying its trade policy is designed to help workers, so too has Canada and many of the discussions around CUSMA. So too has the European Union. So too has Chile. So this narrative around workers and this narrative around empowerment are actually becoming quite normalized. This isn't merely an example of US exceptionalism. So after discussing a bit what I mean by worker-centered trade policy, I'll turn to Mexico, hence the colors of my PowerPoint. I felt like they were missing from our CUSMA discussion. So Mexico is here through colorful PowerPoint. So we're going to choose Mexico as kind of our case study to explain and to show what I mean by empowerment and what the effects of this empowerment through trade has actually made on the lives of workers and Mexico's trade sectors, stemming from a report that we just concluded. And then we can think about what the implications of those findings are for trade policy, both today and for tomorrow, if we all agree, as I feel like we should, that workers are central to the trade agenda and should not merely be rhetoric of government trade policy. So first, I just want to take a step back. For some of us, this is intuitive, but for those of us who have kind of learned about trade from the trade rules and the GATT and the WTO, it's not always so obvious. So there are multiple reasons why policymakers, politicians, advocates care about this link between trade and labor and this role of kind of empowerment of workers. And just to note that this isn't exclusive. It's not as if you find yourself on one side, you don't also find yourself on the other. So many, and I would say the origins of the trade and labor link came from kind of domestic national concerns. So there were concerns that the labor conditions in other countries could hurt national workers owing to liberalized trade. So in the United States, for example, as we were discussing NAFTA and then later what we call USMCA, there was this great concern about auto facilities and the like leaving the United States and moving to Mexico, where the costs of production are cheaper, owing to a number of reasons, including lower wage costs, fewer unions, and the like. And so the concerns about Mexico's labor weren't necessarily because we cared about what was happening in Mexico. Many did, but not everybody. It was that we cared about keeping good jobs in the United States. There's also the concern that if we are competing with countries that have low labor costs and therefore low production costs, that there will be pressure on us to reduce our wages and our working conditions in order to remain competitive. So this, again, we're worried about the labor conditions in another country because we want to protect workers in our country, and we don't want to expose them to vulnerabilities by liberalizing our trade relationship. So this, I would say, was the predominant theory and continues to be in a lot of policy talking circles. More recently, around the 1990s, at least in the United States, you see kind of a transnational labor movement where all of a sudden the discourse changes from we need to monitor labor standards in Mexico to protect workers in the United States and Canada from cheaper competition to we need to care and worry about the labor conditions in Mexico because those workers also don't deserve to be mistreated. They also don't deserve to have to carry the burdens of trade on their shoulders, particularly because they're already so vulnerabilized by being in a country that still remains in economic development. So this more recent kind of trend is almost a cosmopolitan view of what it is to have solidarity in the labor movement. This notion that we're all in this together throughout the supply chain, and that we should leverage our trade policy, we should leverage our markets in order to ensure that workers around the world have some benefit, some level of protection, right? So these are kind of the predominant themes. And one thing that's striking about these different themes, notwithstanding the fact that one is national and one is a bit more global, is they tend to have the same solution. So whether it's because we care about workers in Canada or whether we care about workers in Mexico, both concerns are somewhat assuaged if we can come up with common labor standards that countries have to continue to respect if they hope to engage in trade. The way that we've tended to do that are with labor provisions and trade agreements. So often you learn about trade agreements as kind of a treaty or a contract between governments, and there's various commitments made, not just about tariff rates, but rules of origin, dispute settlement, and the like. Well, just as you have these traditional trade agreement chapters, since the 1990s, we've had labor chapters. Well, I shouldn't say since the 1990s because NAFTA was a side agreement, but definitely since the 2000s. So these commitments, like any others, commit the trade partners to a common set of rules. And I'm not going to make this overly complicated by describing what those rules are and are not, but suffice it to say, for our purposes, that those rules have been government to government, so state to state, just as anything else, to ensure that workers and trade sectors in a manner affecting trade, as some might say, have to follow that or still get the same benefits, right? So this is our way of making sure that Canada and the United States aren't losing good jobs to cheaper wages in Mexico. It's also our way of ensuring that Mexican workers aren't being vulnerabilized owing to the conditions of trade. Is everyone with me so far? Okay. So under the Biden administration, well, let me back up for just a second. Under the Trump 1 administration, we began negotiating the CUSMA, as you guys call it. We call it the USMCA. Everyone thinks of it as kind of a NAFTA 2.0, right? So for years, there had been growing discontent about NAFTA, what it was producing, the externalities of NAFTA on workers, and the like. So at least in the United States and Congress, there was kind of a huge uproar about NAFTA as being unfair. Trump, being Trump, threatened to completely withdraw out of it unless the parties came to the negotiations table. Canada, the United States, and Mexico came together, and over a couple of years in 2020, they ratified this new trade agreement that did a number of really interesting things, particularly when it comes to labor. So just as in previous agreements, USMCA has a labor chapter, right, that stipulates to certain common baseline rules, but it also has a really interesting new innovation called the Rapid Response Mechanism, or the RRM. The Rapid Response Mechanism was designed by congressional Democrats to ensure that the United States not only could enforce certain Mexican laws, which we'll talk about in a second, could enforce those laws in trade sectors, but also that the U.S. government could enforce those laws against private facilities in Mexico. So no longer the state-to-state dispute settlement, but rather the U.S. government, and Canada has its own version of the rapid response mechanism, I should mention, they can actually take enforcement action against a Mexican facility because that Mexican facility will have violated the labor laws in Mexico. It's kind of surprising to many of us lawyers. One of the important features of the rapid response mechanism is that they can be instigated, these cases begun, by workers and local unions on the ground in Mexico. So I have a separate research project that's looking at this kind of through the lens of a whistleblower law. I don't know if you guys are familiar with whistleblower laws, but it's a way of saying, how do we inject some sunlight into these otherwise obscure global supply chains? Well, let's give the workers there a voice. Let's give the workers there a platform so that they can raise attention to the U.S. raise attention to the U.S. government in order to take enforcement. And this begins our narrative around empowerment. This notion that through our trade agreement, we are empowering workers in the Mexican supply sectors by giving them a platform, by giving them a voice and the enforcement of their own labor rights. This was something that was unheard of. One of the big complaints under NAFTA was that workers never had kind of the value, the power to bring a case to a panel. That there were misgivings, but those misgivings were always kind of handled through consultations, and that was there were never the teeth of economic sanctions. So under the Trump administration, this empowerment notion began to unfold, not out of altruism, but pragmatics. This idea that if we give workers a platform to highlight their abuses, we in the United States will be better informed to take enforcement action and equalize the conditions of competition. The Biden administration was effectively the Trump administration when it came to a lot of trade issues. I mean, people worry about what are the differences between Biden and Trump, and we can talk about those. But in the small sphere of trade and labor, they were basically the same person. The only difference is they use different rhetoric. So Trump would say, we're going to aggressively enforce USMCA's rapid response mechanism in Mexico because we care about American workers. The Biden administration took the exact same mechanism, took the exact same modalities, took the exact same approach. But instead of saying it's for American workers, they say, well, we're doing it for American workers and to empower workers in Mexico. Enter empowerment. For, and we'll talk about this in a second, during the entire Biden administration, true to its word, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative aggressively used this tool dozens of times to enforce rights against Mexican facility owners in the name of the Mexican workers. Now Biden is left and a lot of people question, well, is this kind of a moot point? Are we done with this discussion of empowerment and trying to uplift workers in the name of trade? But just last week, as you see here, Trump too, so the new ambassador for trade under the Trump administration, Jameson Greer, who I worked with under the previous administration, reaffirmed his commitment to continue to use the rapid response mechanism aggressively in order to ensure that the conditions of competition remain even. So this, I would argue, makes Mexico a very interesting case study for those of us interested in understanding better the relationship between trade and worker rights. This is a new initiative, so we can actually get data from the before and the after, not necessarily a causal, but certainly a correlative effect that's more difficult in the year priors. I got my degree originally in political science and international relations. So for me personally, it's very interesting to see how the geopolitical power dynamics between powerful countries and less powerful countries come to play. You've got the United States as the police of fair labor standards in Mexico. So we can see what that dynamic does. And again, this is all coming out of a promise. A promise to remedy the ailments of NAFTA that failed to protect workers for decades, right? So Mexico, to people like myself, is a very interesting case study to be able to kind of observe what the effects of all of these empowerment initiatives are doing to the actual lives of workers in Mexico. So let's talk about what's going on in Mexico. Before NAFTA began really to be reproduced under CUSMA USMCA, we had the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. So this is, well, I shouldn't say it's defunct. It's only defunct for us. It's still quite alive and well for many countries. But the idea was the United States used its leverage under the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, to ask countries to do a whole lot of things, including asking Mexico to revise its labor laws. Mexico refused to do so publicly, but many of these conversations took place in parallel and behind closed doors, as do many trade negotiations today. As a result of those negotiations that then bled into USMCA, Mexico underwent a huge labor reform, beginning with in 2017 with a change to its constitution, and then more concretely in 2019 with a significant overhaul of its labor legislation. Now, according to the Mexican government, this overhaul kind of falls, as you can see, into three pillars. These pillars are designed to address the type of labor system that Mexico had before these negotiations began. Mexico was effectively the Wild West of labor relations. It had sham unions that ironically were called protection unions because they were designed to protect the employers. So often the employers would kind of make deals with these unions even before it had hired any workers, even before it had begun production. And the idea was it would codify these collective bargaining agreements. So these are agreements that cover workers in a given sector. They stipulate wages and the like. They would create these collective bargaining agreements that suppressed the wages of workers, that kept the cost of production incredibly low, guaranteeing kind of higher profits. The government was in on this. It was a whole sham. So what the government needed to do in order to continue these trade talks with the United States, among others, was to promise to do away with this fake union system that was artificially suppressing wages and actually come up with a system of representation of workers. So one of the things that its law did was it completely did away with what they were called CABs. So they were basically these government and employer controlled labor arbitration systems that just always ruled in favor of employers. So they did away with that, with this idea of bringing in an independent adjudicatory body. But most importantly for our purposes is the second thing. So up until this point, there was no worker empowerment in Mexico because there was no independent representation of workers. They didn't have any voice. They were told what their wages were. They were told that they couldn't do anything about it, and there were no avenues for dispute. So the employer or the government did two things. First, it introduced a new system where independent unions could get voted on. But it ran into a problem, which is that all of these workers were already covered under these sham collective bargaining agreements. The government needed a way to get rid of those collective bargaining agreements, noting that as a contract, it wasn't really for the government to make a decision as to whether the employers did or did not get rid of them. That was a question for the workers. So they introduced what was called a legitimization process. It's a terrible title, but we're stuck with it because the government came up with it. That legitimization process ended in 2023. What it was, it was a rollout process where workers were given the opportunity to legitimate or reject their existing collective bargaining agreements. When they legitimated it, that meant basically, yeah, we want to stick with our sham collective bargaining agreement and our sham union. If they rejected it, that meant we don't want this agreement and we don't necessarily want the union, which would open the doorway to independent union elections. So this was the government's way of kind of trying to wipe the slate clean, get rid of all the sham representations, and give workers a voice in the sector. It sounds great, right? And so this is what USMCA was designed to do, was to solidify this process, to give this process some enforcement teeth, by making sure that these independent unions actually could come in, making sure that the employers would not shoot them. There's actual violence in Mexico, as I was explaining, Professor Lamp. When we went into Mexico, we had to avoid people walking around the facilities with pistols openly carried in their pants and their waist belts. So our investigators had to avoid this, and the workers knew that their actual lives were at risk if they spoke to us because of this nature in Mexico where these unions, these sham unions, really controlled everything and governments really prospered. So we had questions, as I think many would. We had seen for years the Biden administration use its trade agenda to empower these Mexican workers. Every time the USTR would go into a facility, the US Department of Labor would like bring the poor Mexican workers in front of their photographers and ask them to pose for pictures and talk about how happy they were with the US government's interventions. All of this made at least labor rights advocates like myself a little nervous because, again, a trade agenda can do a lot. It's not necessarily designed for cosmopolitan reasons. And the United States government kept telling us how happy Mexican workers were with the US government, but no one had bothered to ask the workers. So we designed a pilot study to go into Mexico and ask them about their working conditions. At that time, USTR had used the rapid response mechanism 24 times. 17 of those instances were in the auto sector, which is why we chose it to focus on. Of those 17 cases, 4 of the cases had required new legitimization votes. Remember, that's when they were voting to legitimate or to reject their union representatives and collective bargaining agreements. So in 4 of those cases, the question of compliance had been around some shifty activities that had taken place during those elections. 10 of the rapid response cases were resolved with new union elections. And all of those were resolved in favor of bringing in new independent unions. And this is interesting, at least for my purposes. 9 of those rapid response mechanism cases were resolved upon a promise of worker level trainings. And the reason why that's important is because when USMCA was adopted, Congress allocated $200 million to train workers in Mexico about their new labor rights. None of those projects that were funded by Congress were actually centered at workers. So they taught the employers about what the rules were. They taught the government about the rules were, and they taught unions about what the rules were. But none of them actually taught the workers about their new rights. But part of the rapid response mechanism cases required such trainings. So already we were seeing some kind of questionable activities that were interesting to us, like what is going on in these rapid response mechanism cases? And perhaps more importantly, what is going on at the facilities that are not having these rapid response mechanism cases? Are those workers benefiting as well? Notably, and I think I'll get to this. Well, okay. Pause that. I'll get to that in a second. So our project was exploratory. We reached 130 workers, which is the drop in a bucket when we talk about the tens of thousands of workers in the auto sector. But we nevertheless felt it was quite representative. We chose the 7 states of central importance to the Mexican auto sector. We did snowball sampling, and we really ensured to have kind of a sampling of all the types of workers that were involved. Some of these were really big facilities, US owned, some were smaller, some were Mexican owned, some had unions, some did not. And 3 of those facilities had gone through a rapid response mechanism case. So we really had kind of a good sampling of workers that had gone through the rapid response mechanism, workers that did not, workers that were unionized, workers that were not. And we were curious about what their knowledge was. Our view, at least, was that you cannot be empowered. Just as the Biden administration kept saying, these workers were empowered. You cannot be empowered if you don't know your rights. You cannot be empowered if you do not have basic knowledge. You cannot be empowered if you cannot compare what you are receiving to what you should be receiving. You are not empowered, we feel, if you are not aware that you have a platform upon which to exert your grievances. So all of these narratives, all of this discussion of empowerment really turns on variables the government had never proven to us. It hadn't shown us whether workers knew about their rights. It hadn't shown us whether workers knew about the rapid response mechanism. It hadn't shown us whether or not workers were even using the rapid response mechanism. So once again, here's just like a layout of the methodology. So 3 of the 12 facilities weren't unionized. 3 had been subject to rapid response mechanism proceedings. 6 headquartered in the U.S. So we really wanted to ensure we were reaching both big facilities, small facilities, and the like, to ensure as much as possible that we could be representative of what's going on in the Mexican sector. One notable fact that concerned us was that at the time of issuing this project, every petition that had successfully ignited a rapid response mechanism case had been carried out with the assistance of the United States. So this shows the actual petitioner, right? So it shows like a small margin were Mexican workers. Nevertheless, in our discussions with the US Solidarity Center in Mexico, the AFL-CIO and Mexican unions, we learned that each of these parties were able to carry out the petitions that successfully galvanized this enforcement action through the assistance of US stakeholders. So that is to say, they already had some kind of connections with the United States. All right, so this is what we found. And just briefly speaking, we found significant disparities in the level of worker knowledge and confidence and legitimacy and trust between workers at facilities that had not participated in the rapid response mechanism and those that had. So I'm going to walk you through that. And against that backdrop, I want you to keep in mind that those that had participated in the rapid response mechanism all already benefited from connections with the United States. So just briefly speaking, showing this graph, a little bit over half of the workers knew that Mexico had undertaken these huge labor law reforms. And I actually think that's pretty good. If you go into the United States auto sector and you ask them about the National Labor Relations Act, you're not going to get a high level of awareness, right? So some might look at that and feel discouraged because here there had been this monumental labor reform and here you only have a little over the half workers that are aware of it. But I would say that's actually pretty good as a labor rights advocate. It shows that it's getting down at least to some workers. However, when you break it down further to see who are these 56% of the workers, it's actually quite different. They're the rapid response mechanism facility workers. It's the workers that received the trainings. It's the workers that received the help. When you get to non-rapid response mechanism facilities, so that is auto facilities still in trade sector, still producing the same goods, less than half are even aware that Mexico had just revised its labor laws to ensure that they were entitled to independent union representation. They had no idea. So then I was also very curious about the legitimization process. So again, this is the process of legitimating or rejecting their collective bargaining agreement because of how important that process was. If workers chose to legitimate or didn't vote, that means that they're still strapped into this really substandard bargaining agreement where they don't get to try to fight for higher wages, right? And they're stuck with these sham unions. So this legitimization process was brand new. No one had ever heard of it. And it was crucial to actually changing the conditions of work in Mexico. This was after the legitimization period ended. 60% of workers had no idea what a legitimization process was. They'd never heard of it. We then kind of kept going. We said, well, which ones of you actually participated in a legitimization process? And so from those of you who cast a vote, who among you actually felt like you knew what you were voting on? And here we have 60% said, okay, I know. 40% said, I had no idea what I voted. But here's what's worse. Of those 60%, we would say, well, what did you vote? And they'd say, well, we voted to legitimate the contract. Well, why did you vote to legitimate the contract? Because we wanted to bargain for better working conditions. So we found that even those workers who felt that they could tell us with confidence that they understood the process, that had voted without understanding what the process was. And notably, some 98% of the sham collective bargaining and agreements in Mexico were legitimated. Then we looked at the rapid response mechanism facilities to see, okay, and one thing to keep in mind just between us, between friends, all of the rapid response mechanism facilities that we interviewed had gone through new legitimization processes. Every single one of them, with the help of the United States government, voted to reject their collective bargaining agreements and to vote in an independent union. However, if you look at the outcome of our study, a quarter of the workers thought that their collective bargaining agreements had been legitimated, when in fact they were rejected. So even amongst those at the rapid response mechanism case facilities, there was a striking lack of familiarity and understanding of these new kind of democratic processes that had been unrolled, hoping to be able to start over in this bargaining regime. Then, and only because we're a little ornery, we asked them about their views. This has nothing to do with empowerment and more to do with, like, what do Mexican workers feel about, like, the big, powerful, the U.S. government interfering in their labor relations? And actually, I felt like this was a real, like, real politic moment in my own investigation. And it suggested sort of a parochialism on my part. See, here, I thought we were going to go into these facilities and find that Mexican workers really didn't like the presence of the U.S. government. And in fact, what we found was a far greater savviness amongst Mexican workers than I had given them credit for. So that, like, over half of them were like, yeah, U.S. government's interfering, you know, with the labor practices here to help U.S. workers. I mean, It's probably also trying to help us. So like 50-50, it's probably trying to do both. Oh yeah, and it's probably also trying to raise the costs of our production so that it can make more money at home. It's probably also trying to exercise power over the Mexican government. All of the above. Like the US government's probably achieving a lot. Later on, it's not a slide here, but later on we ask them, given this, these like complicated feelings, what do you want the US government to do? Like, should the US government back off, you know, if it's acting out of self-interest? And the workers, the majority of the workers were like, I mean, when they're here, we get paid more. So they can keep, like, they want to exercise power over Mexico. They can exercise power over Mexico so long as, you know, we end up making more money out of it. So it was this really like radical view of, yes, we understand the US government is trying to pull a lot of things, but it can keep doing so if it's going to give us greater rights. All right. So against this kind of complicated backdrop, as all surveys of human beings tend to be quite complicated, one of the questions that I'm asking myself now is what does this mean? So at least for me, I find it quite troubling that we go into Mexico to help raise the standards of living of vulnerable workers. And what we're doing is we're creating kind of two buckets of workers. On the one hand, we have the truly invisible workers, the workers that are in the trade sector and the auto sector that have no ties to US unions. They have no heroes in US Congress. They are therefore not interesting to USTR, and they have received no attention under the rapid response mechanism, no worker level trainings, no new legitimization processes, no new union elections. In our other bucket, we have workers that are relatively privileged. They're relatively privileged because they have stakeholders in the United States fighting for them. And I'm not suggesting that this is a bad thing. This is a great thing. This is why those workers are privileged, because they have transnational solidarity working in their favor. They get extra money from the wages that end up as a result of their independent collective bargaining agreement. They get actual representation. They have an actual voice. They are more empowered. But is that what we're trying to do? Are we trying to bifurcate and atomize workers across the world? Are we trying to help those that are important to us politically while ignoring those who probably need the most help? I mean, maybe the answers would be different, but that's not where I come when I think about empowerment in the global supply chain, particularly throughout developing countries. But this isn't new also. In the 1990s, there was this huge initiative, an empowerment initiative. It was usually in the form of indigenous rights empowerment and women's rights empowerment. So all of a sudden, in the context of financial development, banks and governments and all of these really strong actors were going to empower the vulnerable of the world, right? And that obviously didn't happen because none of these groups are actually empowered today. So Sen did a lot of research on this at his time, and he looked particularly at the way development institutions were seeking to empower women workers and empower indigenous communities. And he found that they weren't actually empowering anybody. And the reason why is because these top-down types of initiatives that were just kind of throwing resources at local communities had no idea what was going on in those local communities. They didn't understand what the capabilities were. They didn't understand where the deficiencies were, because there was nothing on the bottom. There was no investigation. There was no getting to know the actual vulnerable communities. There was just this real kind of parochial dismissal and throwing of resources that ended up exacerbating a lot of the power imbalances that started off. Nevertheless, as he's writing about empowerment, development banks in particular, I guess they were suffering from a PR problem, really started embracing the empowerment ambition, much the same way that the Biden administration did. So all of a sudden you have like the IMF and the World Bank and the IDB, all of these financial institutions claiming to be empowering the recipients of their funds. But nevertheless, as we follow the development of those funds, we find in fact that inequalities increased, that the vulnerable became more vulnerable, not just because of the structural adjustment programs that were going on at the time, but because of the way that the resources were being utilized in recipient countries. Through SEN, feminist scholarship, and other works, they started to kind of create a theory of empowerment and development. And there is this recognition that when institutions, when governments, when trade agreements go into a local community, there's a lot already going on the ground. There's already power plays. There's already different resource distributions among local communities. And if there's no recognition of that, then what ultimately ends up happening is that the privileged become more privileged. And I'll give you an example. There's a women's empowerment notion amongst many of the development banks that if they could create events that brought women to the events and got the women to participate, then that meant that the women were empowered. What they failed to recognize, though, is that women didn't have the flexibility to attend all these events. Women were the caregivers. Women were at home trying to take care of their family on top of trying to work. The last thing these women needed was one more demand on their time. But they were being forced to participate in these events so that the banks could kind of check these boxes. Ultimately, what happened is the women who attended were the elite women who could afford childcare. During these events where the poor women, the most tasked women were not there because they were busy caring for their family and the powerful women were in attendance, those powerful women got to decide how the resources were going to be allocated and what type of regime do you think that they established? So again, the objectives were noble, right? Laudable objectives of empowering women through these development resources, but without taking a snapshot of the pre-existing power dynamics between the elite and the not elite and the pre-existing demands on women's time, by coming up with this outcome being participation, bodies and chairs, these initiatives ended up harming the vulnerable groups of women who couldn't make it to the meetings. So this has begun some thinking around what type of antecedent, what type of ex-ante types of measures need to be taken before top-down policies can even pretend to be empowering local communities. That is to say that before the resources roll out, before enforcement begins to happen, some type of stock taking needs to be taken place, particularly even in labor. Oftentimes, if you go into a working factory, there are already informal ways to resolve disputes. The workers on the ground already know a lot about their working facility. If you don't take that into account, if you just throw money at different facilities, require one system of dispute settlement, you actually run the risk, as we did with women, of furthering these pre-existing power imbalances. And I think this is what our USMCA Rapid Response Mechanism study captured when it showed that those workers already with links, already with privilege, ended up benefiting significantly more when it came to factors of empowerment, such as knowledge and participation, than those without such links. So this is making me think about the future. Trade and labor, that link is not going to go away for a number of reasons, including the fact that you have strong trade partners increasingly embracing the recognition that workers are the most critical aspect of trade, that without them, you have no trade, and that if you don't treat them equitably, if you do not include them, if you do not allow their participation and their voice, your economy will suffer. So because of that, I'm trying to think of how can we establish an empowerment framework in trade that actually responds to these local needs. And what I think it requires is a lot more of action before trade agreements are negotiated, when leverage is highest, before enforcement comes out. And here, just like this is still kind of percolating, so I'm open to your thoughts as well. The first ex-ante provisions that establish or think through training exercises and worker level approaches from the beginning to become part of that local community. The capacity building that we've seen under USMCA, once again, has all been top down. We administer it from the top. We throw it at employers. We throw it at unions. We throw it at the government. We assume it's going to trickle down at some point to these workers who we claim empowerment. Instead, it has to start at the bottom. It has to actually start with the vulnerable recipients of this aid so that they know what their rights are. There have to be further studies of the local communities. Mexican auto facilities are not going to be like other sectors in Mexico that are certainly not going to be like U.S. auto facilities. These are all idiosyncratic types of entities with their own relationships and histories. There has to be a lot more work in this area before our trade agreements can purport to empower them. Those approaches necessarily will be different. They'll be pluralistic. One size does not always fit all, particularly not in labor relations. And finally, one of the things our report captured is while the workers were happy to have their wages increased by the Mexican the U.S. government, those workers did not trust the U.S. government. But if you don't trust the government you're supposed to blow the whistle to, you're not going to risk the pistols. You're not going to risk getting blacklisted. You're not going to risk not having food on your table by trusting that actor with showing violations. So all of this is a process, is what I'm trying to get to before the actual enforcement sets in. All right. So that concludes. I'd like to turn it all over to you now for questions and comments. Thank you.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Mellow Lily's newest release, Symphony, capturing the joy and spontaneity of music discovered in everyday life. Inspired by busking on the streets of Kingston, the song blends ukulele, bass, and drums into a bright, uplifting sound. With cheerful, inviting vocals, it delivers a simple but powerful message. Music isn't confined to stages or studios. It's all around us, waiting to be heard if we take a moment to listen. Are you a local musician who would like to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Symphony by Mellow Lily on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Oh, yeah. Wouldn't it be great to eat gourmet food from some of Kingston's top chefs all in one place? Well, you can. If you attend Savor Spring, a culinary experience on Saturday, May 2nd, for an evening of exceptional food, local talent, and community spirit that will make a meaningful impact for students across KFLNA. Savor Spring, a culinary experience, brings together six of Kingston's standout chefs for an immersive dining event supporting the Food Sharing Project, a local charity that ensures local students have full access to nutritious breakfast, lunch, and snacks at school. Guests will enjoy interactive stations from Aquaterra, Baja Craft Kitchen, Bella Bistro, Kudo Catering, Crave Coffee House, and Days on Front, along with a welcome cocktail, raw bar, local wine, live music, and a silent auction. It's a rare chance to experience the creativity of six local restaurants under one roof while supporting students in the community. We are so proud to be part of Savor Spring, a night where Kingston's best kitchens come together for something bigger than food, says Chef Chris Kudo of Kudo Catering. That's the vision we stand behind. Good food, real impact, one table. Tickets are on sale now and going fast. Visit www.foodsharingproject.org/savorspring to grab yours today.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present the lead single from Rust Pump's debut eponymous EP. The song Drool Again stands out as the lead track, blending classic rock influences with a modern edge, while the song's use of seventh chords creates a melancholic, dreamy atmosphere that mirrors its exploration of a couple seeking relief through substance use. Both intimate and dynamic, Drool Again has become a favorite of the band and a lasting highlight of their sound. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Drool Again by Rust Pump on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Never, ever, ever. Attention Ontario pickleball players. The Maple Leaf Pickleball Club invites you to the Smash for a Cause charity tournament in support of Jumpstart Charities. This action-packed day of competition